Singapore, everyone goes, wow. And science has a wow factor to it. Science is the way to get, you know, literacy and numeracy are embedded in science. Everything we see around us, when you, anyone listening, you look around the room, everything around you has an element of design, innovation, materials, engineering, what have you. So science is this way of pulling in literacy and numeracy.
That was Neil Branson, an incredibly motivated primary teacher who's making a massive impact at his school at Mount Ousley Public School. Everything from drones and bird watching through to launching air balloons in Western New South Wales, Neil has done it, and he really has travelled all over the world to do it. No wonder he's got the Prime Minister's Prize for Excellence in Science Teaching in Primary Schools.
You're listening to the Physics Ed Podcast. For hundreds of ideas, free experiments and more, go to physicseducation.com.au. And now, here's your host, Ben Newsome.
Yes, welcome again to another Physics Ed podcast. Big show this week. We have a very special guest in Neil Branson, who's fresh off winning a massive prize from the Prime Minister's office. I tell you what, he's been very busy on radio and TV, and that's going to continue for a little while longer yet. But he was good enough to drop in to have a bit of a chat with us about what he's been doing with his outdoor education with his primary school and well beyond that. Bit of an interview here. Definitely get a pencil, get a piece of paper, and if you're walking the dog, you might have to go back into the room and listen all again, because Neil has a lot to share and it's well worth our time. Let's dive right in.
This is the Physics Ed Podcast.
Yes, you have had a flat out week. Describe what's, I suppose, happened to you.
So I guess last week was a once in a lifetime type experience. It was the culmination of the Prime Minister's Science Prizes and being fortuitous enough to, I guess, receive the Prime Minister's Prize for Science Excellence in Primary Teaching. And that was really nice because it was nominated by a couple of parents, and that process started many months ago. And it was a nice surprise driving down the snow probably about 7 weeks ago to get a phone call outside Coomera to say, hey, you're the winner. And it was like, wow, that'll top off a great weekend. And then it went in. Pardon?
So first you got dobbed in and then you get called up like it's the Nobel Prize. Like, so out of the blue, you don't even know it's coming.
That's right. And then it was like, don't say anything for a couple of weeks because it'll all go through embargo and media and so on. And so, look, we had a little film crew come in from Questacon and Wild Bear Productions, and then really nice last week to get to meet with the other teacher, her secondary teacher from Kirrawee High in Sydney. Great to see two department schools there.
Yep.
Just really lovely to share with the actual scientists who I think are the main achievers in that front, and just very humble, modest but inspiring people who love to give back but who had a lot to offer, and their knowledge and depth is something to be commended.
Well, that's nothing taken away from what you do, though. I mean, like, you've got scientists and, yeah, they do their thing, but, I mean, science educators, their job is to get kids into science eventually. I mean, that is an important role, a critical role. And, look, these sort of things don't come in overnight. You've been doing this stuff for years. And I'm just out of interest. I mean, what would have sparked people's attention that was happening down at Mount Ousley?
Yeah, I mean, I have been doing it for years, and I was thinking the other day, I was explaining or talking to a few staff members, and I said, to me, it's probably the culmination of 10 to 12, 14 years of doing science in the primary school context, starting out small, basically with an ICT technology drive, but always having that interest in science. And I'm an electrician by trade, so I guess there's a little bit of competence and fun with wires. Not that I'd be rewiring any houses in the near future.
What made you jump out of that? Like, okay, ignoring the education for a little bit, I'm always curious about what drives people to do things. Now, you're a sparky by trade, so you're an electrician. Yeah. What decided, you know what, I'm going to go put my hand in and start teaching kids?
Yep. And I'm going to have a great story here, because I was someone who disliked high school and disengaged in high school. I was always very capable and in the top classes, but I left in year 10. And I remember thinking back that I really didn't enjoy science. They stuck a science book in front of me. Science teacher stood at the front looking very bored and hungover. And I thought, you know, I'm not really loving this and getting this. I did enjoy geography and a couple of other subjects.
Yep.
But I thought, you know, what, I want to go out and do some other things. And I lived in Wollongong, and I got offered an engineering traineeship out of year 10, which sort of went to most people in year 12. So I was kind of had a bit of a head start there. And I jumped into that, and I probably wasn't the best student at TAFE. And after 4 years of crawling through grease pits and changing motor bushes and so on, I jumped out of being an electrician and went ski bumming for a few years.
Yeah.
But I think I fell into outdoor education, which is really what got me into teaching. I was in the UK. I was traveling. I was teaching canoeing and climbing and all those lovely things in an outdoor ed centre. And I was heading back to Australia, and I thought, well, I think working with students is something that's connected with me. The environment had connected with me, which probably enabled science because environmental ed is a passion of mine. And then before you know it, you're back at uni and you're a mature age student in your early 20s, albeit. Got a job. I was fortunate to get posted to Manly Village where I started my teaching career. So I've sort of come through it circular. I also got out of teaching for a little while and did some sales and marketing within education. And then I got back in again. And then obviously I've stayed in for the last 10 years and it's been very good for me because I'm in a place where I need to be. And I've often said to people, teaching is the best job or the worst job in the world, depending on your mindset.
Isn't that the truth?
Simply because of the effect you have on everyone around you, but importantly, the kids, that, you know, if you're not the right person, you really shouldn't be there.
Oh, you bet.
Leverage it.
Yeah, you're a force multiplier for good or not so good.
Yeah, totally.
I tell you what, as an outdoor education enthusiast, I mean, you couldn't be have too bad of a run being at Mount Ousley. It's a beautiful spot of the world.
Yeah, it is. And I think I was lucky in that when I was living at Jervis Bay and I was teaching at Sussex Inlet, and Sussex Inlet Public School had a huge couple of acres at the back of the school with an actual, some existent remnant forest and a nature trail cut through.
Yeah.
And that's what really enabled me to get back into science teaching and particularly environmental education, because I was running bird watching before school for both students and parents. And that was really well received in that some parents would come up and say, we don't get to spend a lot of time with the kids because of our work and shifts and whatever, but this is an opportunity for my son and I, this was a father, to spend half an hour bonding in just a different way where they could both come into it from a different angle. That wasn't something I was looking for when I started it. It was more just, let's go for a walk, let's enjoy the bird life, let's enjoy a bushwalk before school. But it started to leverage into something a little bit more, and that's something that is one of those serendipitous discoveries you get in education that keeps you moving forward. And then from Sussex, I was able to build into space science. I got to Honeywell Space Camp. I was never a strong space science person before that.
Yeah.
I've looked at the stars and the planets, but I've never understood in depth too much. I've enjoyed the romanticism of space science and exploration, but I was not a space junkie in the sense of some people that just live for their space education. But going to space camp, keeping the science going, and then picking up I was teaching RFF and technology, and I picked up a Premier's Environmental Education Scholarship to the States to look at environmental ed and the use of technology back in the about 2008. And that was a chance to visit some schools in the US and institutions that were starting to use ICT. This was when an iPod was a cool thing, and an iPod was a breakthrough in technology. And a couple of outdoor centres had sort of birding calls and bird IDs on iPods, and it was like, wow, this is amazing stuff. And digital cameras, as ever, they still are, were a really good tool. And so I was starting to pull together some environmental aspects of that type of thing along with some space science, supported by technology where appropriate. And then that kind of just kept me moving. And then I was lucky to come up to Mount Ousley, which is, again, you know, in Wollongong, but we're in a suburban area, but we've got some really established trees, old growth turpentines. I was just saying we've got some 20 frogmouths nesting out there at the moment. I think we counted about 12 birds' nests today.
Wow.
Two of which had fledglings and birds being fed, which the kids were able to witness, which is lovely. But we're also pretty close to North Wollongong Beach, and we go down there and do marine debris surveys. Students in 4 to 6 will take a small group down, and we can do an emu walk or a transect study and just look at what the plastics are and other rubbish on the beach, and then just look, well, you know, is it cigarette butts? Are they hard plastics? Are they soft plastics? And try and look at what we think is often a clean space actually is not as clean as we might think. Still pretty good, but we can always do better.
So you've got a lot going on. With all these different lessons, especially the outdoor stuff, I mean, you're certainly taking your kids well out of the classroom, and that's just awesome to see. What years are you doing that with, for example, the transects?
So I'm last couple of years I've been on a stage 2, 1, 3, 4, and before that I taught kindergarten for a couple of years. But now I'm essentially an RFF role, so teaching across all classes for an hour or so a week, predominantly science, also a little bit of maths. And also doing mentoring and coaching on a quality teaching basis one day of the week, and also a little bit of device use. But being able to run this across K to 6 means, you know, this week is Aussie Bird Count week. I've been able to get all the classes out and do a bird survey using ID charts, capturing some data, submitting that data. We also use the BirdLife app, so we can pull out that data down the track and look at, say, long-term studies. And what I'd really like to see is, you know, in 2, 3, 4 years, what is the biodiversity in terms of bird life within the school, and is it increasing, is it decreasing, noisy miners taking over from Indian miners or what have you. But the way in is citizen science for me, because it adds an authenticity and validity to it, and it has a purpose. And the kids, when they see that, if someone might look at their data, they might a scientist might actually call upon it down the track, or they can refer back to it in a table form or what have you. There's an empowering nature to that, and it's something that also gels with parents. It makes it easy to talk about and communicate what you're doing, as there's a sense of understanding.
Well, that citizen science really has boomed, and the New South Wales Inspiring Australia manager, Jackie Randalls, was on the podcast back in episode 4, I believe, talking about all the different citizen science opportunities that are out there. And seriously, there are so many, and you run it straight off your phone. It's unreal.
It is, and I think the great thing, as you say there, Ben, is that with the apps these days, any government agency or not-for-profit that might be running a citizen science program is looking to make data capture easy or easier. And I think with device use and mobile device use and mobile internet, it's very accessible now to go down to the beach or go out to the bush to take photos, you know, at its simplest level and log them, but also to do some sort of online survey material and push it through. Whereas in the past, it was much harder to do that and probably done in more in isolation. So in that sense, citizen science is a boomer, and I think it's got a long way to go.
And I tell you what, I mean, your passion for science is really obvious, especially for primary kids. And not only did you get to go over to the US for the Premier's award, you got yourself over there again with a Churchill Fellowship as well.
Yes, I did. And the Churchill was back in 2013, it was 2014 travel. What was really interesting about that is I was teaching maths, I was teaching science. I've been using technology to support that sort of teaching. So I was looking at particularly what hooks kids into, particularly the middle years. So in the States, you've got that, you know, elementary, middle and high school component, whereas we tend to run primary and secondary. So I was looking at the sort of 10 to 14-year-old bracket, particularly within a context of maths and engineering, which really has now morphed into STEM, which is a somewhat overused and abused acronym, I think, at the moment.
Yeah, STEM, STEAM, STREAM, MES, name your acronym.
I think there's certainly a place for STEM, but it's how it's what is the messaging attached to it and what is the context in which it's been delivered is the important thing. And, but at the time, you know, it was STEM and it was about science, technology, engineering, maths, and then what are some of those integrated type programs or even standalone programs that could support that in middle school. And it was looking at, for me, it was looking at some space opportunities such as high altitude balloon launches, which are great for capturing data because you've got to design and make aspect. You're building the receiver box, you're getting your helium balloons, you're launching in a safe area up to 50,000, 60,000 K. Harder to do on the New South Wales on the East Coast because of flight paths.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. I mean, like, would you, like, in Australia, I suppose you'd have to apply to CASA or something to do that?
Yeah, and it can be done. A couple of schools I do know have done it, but they were, I believe, Sydney schools, but they've really had to drive out to Western New South Wales to find a clear area, launch is easy, but recovery is much harder, and to get out of a flight path. We're on the Sydney to Melbourne flight path, so it would not be looked upon favourably.
Yeah, you make the news for a whole other reason.
You can, yeah. You probably could do a tethered launch whereby you launch the balloon up to, say, a few hundred metres or a K, but I think there's a risk factor there that I'm all for taking risks and learning, but that's probably one too many for a number of reasons that are pretty obvious. But that sort of thing, and in the States I saw some good things happening with middle schools doing that, and I know that program's expanded. I looked at High Tech High in San Diego was a great influence because of their project-based approach. So I was really interested to see that in the mornings they were running somewhat traditional literacy numeracy, core literacy numeracy in isolation, I guess, but still teaching the nuts and bolts. But from middle session onwards, they were tending to collapse those classes and have maybe two classes together with a humanities English teacher and a science maths teacher. So you had two sort of subject matter experts there, and then they would branch into some project work. And one of the things, I saw some great stuff from kindergarten through to year 6-7 from really in-depth physics of cars and wheels and axles in the kindergarten type area through to what I really liked, well, not through to, but as a sort of 3, 4, 5 project was a butterfly garden. And they were, because monarch butterflies are endemic to California, and they're looking to sustain and breed them to a greater degree. They had a garden with the appropriate plants in it, but they also were breeding the monarchs and harvesting eggs, and had a real cycle going, a life cycle going. They'd written a little book to go along with that, because their documentation is through books and curating content. It's high tech, but it's not really a device driven school. It's tech as in technology. Learning
well,
and sorry.
No, I was just thinking. Just Laura McBain was in Australia only recently for the Education Changemakers Week, EduChange Week down in Melbourne only a little while ago, and even the simplest project work can be done with the very young kids can have a profound impact on the way kids develop as makers, doers, and I don't know, just people who are engaged with their world as opposed to thinking it's all about the books. They're really doing a fantastic job.
They are, and it really is. And project-based learning, as was explained to me when I was somewhat of a newbie to it, is really allows an entry point for success for all students, because they can come in and do different things within a greater project. Mm-hmm. In our instance, with our butterfly garden, we had a sort of overgrown garden area, and we looked at what we might do. So we looked at, okay, what do we want to do with this? We don't want another vegetable garden. We want something else. So we looked at butterflies. We looked at the species that would attract them locally. Mm-hmm. We also looked at some milkweed, because we knew that wouldn't bring in monarchs, even though it's not sure that the species we've got's actually endemic to this area. But what was fun was we put a drone up. We put up a phantom drone. We captured some aerial footage of that area. We then mapped that area to work out the area we were working with.
Yep.
We then had the students in groups design a pathway through, design the arrangement of the shrubs and bushes, design the paths, where might benches go. So they were doing a visual aspect. I guess the art comes into that there. We then looked at volume of mulch we might need and volume of gravel on the paths. We looked at, what sort of seating do we want for not a whole class maybe, but maybe half a class as a quiet area or as a reading area. We sourced some benches that were the kids finally actually assembled that they purchased from Bunnings. But we also costed it, and the students rang up and ordered the materials from the local landscape supplier with the school credit card and put their order in and watched it be delivered. So they really saw that project through. And that's a project that, you know, you think you might do it in one term, but, you know, 3 terms later you're still working away. And that is the biggest thing with project-based learning, giving yourself as the teacher or instructor time to let it happen. Some of it's organic and it flows off in different directions, but it really is about backward mapping what you do back into the syllabus, because we're all accountable to some, well, we are accountable to deliver the syllabus. And I think where schools sometimes find fear, or teachers find fear, or supervisors is, well, what does this look like and how do you plan for it? I think with a lot of the things I do, I look for the opportunity that will stimulate and engage the students, and then I backward map that into my predominantly maths and English syllabus. And then looking back at scope and sequence, or scope, not so much sequence, but particularly scope, go back and see what do I need to fill in, where have I got some gaps that I need to hit up. And some of that might be real traditional teaching. I've got no issue with that. And traditional teaching for me is working with groups of 3 or 4 in a small group. It's very rarely whole class delivery, maybe for an introduction occasionally. But project-based does offer that way in for everybody. It offers hands-on learning. Everyone has a degree of ownership. You can support and scaffold students at different levels of interest and need. You backward map into your syllabus and you give yourself plenty of time. That's my takeaway.
I bet. And, I mean, obviously this would almost sound incredibly daunting for someone who's brand new to teaching, going, I've got to do all this stuff. But then again, you're 10 years down the track and then some.
What does it look like? How do I make it work? And I think you start small, and it doesn't have to be in project-based learning. Can be a simple thing. It can be as simple as getting new garbage bins for school. So, you know, one of the things I've looked at is a lot of schools have old metal bins. Okay, let's not just go out and buy them. Let's give the students ownership. let's get the students to research the amount of waste we're generating. Let's do some waste and data, waste surveys. We've got some data to play around with. We can then work out, well, how many bins do we need in certain areas of the school? We can then work out the volume of the of a Sulo type bin, a contemporary bin. What colours do we want? Are we going to cut slots in the top so it's easy for kids to put rubbish in and hard for birds to get in and or pest birds and so on?
One of the best art things I saw done with a rubbish bin like that. So, yeah, the big green bin. So those people overseas just think about, I don't know, 4 foot high and however many feet wide. But I've saw one converted into a fantastic wheel-out solar-powered speaker system, like a PA system. It's brilliant. And the kids painted it up. It's unreal.
And that's it. And that's tinkering and making and a bit of STEM in there as well, I think. So a lot of this is about, I've said to teachers, look for opportunities around the school for you to make a difference. Obviously a physical change is a good one because something is seen and valued. Look for something that's accessible, where success can be achieved in a reasonable time frame. I think gardening is a great example. Anything that is, gardening is good because there's a start point, there's an end point. You can do it on a term basis. You can look at bigger community type things. If you're near beaches, you can do debris surveys. I mean, ours was initially through Teach Wild and the CSIRO, which was a national project. It's ceased now, but you can still log data. You can still use logbooks and make that happen. And then it's really, you know, some of it's teacher passion driven. I think if the teacher has a passion for certain areas of learning, they can run with that. The students can come up with ideas. A lot of it is discussion about what can we do and where can we go. Knowing along the way you will make mistakes. And, you know, one of the big things within my school at Mount Easley is we have a huge culture of trust. The principal trusts the staff trusts the students. When people slip up, they get a friendly reminder about what trust is and about responsibility is and about the need to manage learning and for I guess, kids to manage their own learning and take ownership of that and for staff to push the kids in a good way and to get out of the classroom. So one of the things that's been interesting with this experience is the sort of pickup of the outdoor classroom, which was not something I was thinking a lot about, but it's sort of been tagged the outdoor classroom. And we're lucky in that we've just had a new outdoor learning area constructed, which has an old surf life-saving surf boat there. It's got a aluminium tinny, little fishing boat. It's got a lot of wooden logs in the set up in a campfire approach. There's a stone wall to sit on. There's musical instruments. There's, importantly, because we're a one-to-one school with devices K-6, iPads and MacBooks, we've built purpose storage for devices outside so that when the kids are maybe doing some art or doing some reading or numeracy and they're not using their device at that time, we're not just going to put it on the ground and run the risk of damage. We're going to be responsible. We're going to put it in a storage area. So we're trying to think of these things that make it easy. You've got to make it easy for students to get out there, and you've got to make it easy for staff and teachers to take the little risks by putting the infrastructure, the essential stuff in place.
I love how you're allowing people to fail a little. I mean, that's so important. You know, everyone from the teachers all the way down to the students. And in that note, I mean, I know for a fact, like, the number of times I've messed stuff up, it keeps on happening. Yeah. But, I mean, just even just thinking back, I mean, just all the different lessons that you've run, you know, day in, day out, are there anything that sort of popped to mind where you're going, you know what, looking back, what was I thinking? and it just went completely pear-shaped.
I've never had a real biggie. I was thinking about this. I can't say I've had anything that scared the living daylights out of me.
Oh, that's good.
I've done a lot of rocket launches with model rockets and bottle rockets.
Okay.
Occasionally, I can think of launches that have the bottle rocket. We've had a couple of bottle rockets go a lot further than I thought they would in terms of distance and velocity.
Yep.
Because the students have got the nose cone weight balance right, which is a real key with bottle rockets. And I thought, well, I'm glad that didn't end up over the fence in someone's backyard while they were putting the washing out.
Oh, have you ever seen the ones that are multi-staged where you have bottle rocket and rocket then rocket again and the thing just 300 or 400 metres in the air?
We joined in the Illawarra Aerial Nautical Association. There was a school rocketry comp at Wollongong Uni about 8 weeks ago when we were fortunate enough to join in with other schools from the state, and there were some very long-distance launches that disappeared into the trees.
Right.
It's interesting to see what you can do with a bottle rocket when you get it right and you get the right amount of pressure in there. A lot of my things have been Some of my fizzes actually have been model rockets as well. When the kids have built their model rocket and we've gone out to launch and the igniter hasn't taken and so on. So you've got to just check it carefully and redo it. So it's usually parents and people waiting on hand with expectations. So there might be a 3-minute delay for safety while you check things and relaunch. But look, a lot of mine are, I mean, I do a lot of science, I guess, and it's, I always say to the students with science, if something doesn't work or come to what you're expecting, that's fine, because with a hypothesis, it doesn't always eventuate as you might wish or think. And when we do things in class, we might do something as simple as, you know, hydrogen peroxide, elephant's toothpaste, for example, hydrogen peroxide, detergent and yeast, and we might get a bigger reaction than we thought, or we might get a lesser reaction because we changed an ingredient. With all of the sciencey stuff I do, the kids tend to enjoy it because it's, and I think any teacher that does this sort of stuff, the students would enjoy it because it's that visual stimulation. It's like when I was at school and I watched the Curiosity Show or Julius Sumner Miller, or everyone goes, wow. And science has a wow factor to it. Science is the way to get, you know, literacy and numeracy are embedded in science. Everything we see around us, when you, anyone listening, you look around the room, everything around you has an element of design, innovation, materials, engineering, what have you. So science is this way of pulling in literacy and numeracy, and it shouldn't stand alone as it sometimes does. And I said down to the Prime Ministers in my speech that we have far too much of a focus on standardised testing at the expense of the other learning areas. And it's sad when science, and particularly in the States, science might be pushed away because there's a pressure to deliver in literacy or numeracy in some measurable way that everybody is then judged on.
Yeah. I think we can't hear it, but I believe there'd be applause right around the world listening to this podcast right about now, because change is coming. Like, you can see it happening. It's going to take a long process, but it'll get there.
And you do need rigorous assessment, and you do need accountability, and you do need programming, and nothing this is overly, you're not winging it. It's done with purpose. But you don't have to get yourself so tied down in a textbook or program that you're too scared to deflect from that program or diverge. Because if you don't do instruction 3 of page 4 of lesson 5, the world will collapse. Or your supervisor will jump on top of you and say you are a bad teacher or a bad person. If they did, they're a bad supervisor. But I think some programs, you know, such as Primary Connections, are a great jumping off point for people developing their skills and confidence. And I think there's a great place for them. But to me, they are always a jumping off point, and they shouldn't constrain other ideas, options and ways of delivering things innovatively.
Which I think was what Primary Connections was always designed to be. It's great for some who, you know, build a lot of their curriculum around it, but it was really designed for, you know, the people who want to really deep dive into science. It's just it's a good starting point. Like, yeah, the diving blocks off a board.
That's right. And I think I only reference Primary Connections because it is probably one of the more well-known programs within Australia, and with a lot of justification and out of the Academy of Science. So it is a really strong piece of work. I would just like to see everyone use that maybe as their base and then complement and extend with their own teaching, learning and ideas. And then I think you will get that much deeper, rich learning that can occur. So and then you get to keep smiling and laughing and going, I'm enjoying this. I want, you know, it's using math, it's using the language, you are a scientist. You will think like a scientist. You are a mathematician. Let's use that meta language of maths. Let's have good, deep conversations and really think about what we're doing here.
So with this sort of platform that you've got, obviously there is a bit of a loudspeaker to you, which is fantastic. And so hopefully people are listening, you know, Australia-wide and beyond. That inevitably means that you'll be put in, you know, various university lecture theatres and all that sort of thing. Imagine if you had, like, I don't know, 1 minute, give maybe two, 2 minutes tops. So where it's like, right, pre-service primary teachers, this is my one piece of advice I'm going to give you. Please listen to it and take it to heart. I guess, what would you say if you're only given a short window of time to these people who are about to influence our kids?
Yeah, I think the message is you have to hook kids into learning. The more that you can hook them in and engage them in hands-on, exciting, it is stimulating, it is hooking them. It's literally giving them a buzz, and then that's your starting point to drill into your deeper, heavier learning without doubt. It's also to get outside, use the environment around you. I think we neglect that far too often. Learning, and this is important for both teachers and students, it needs to be a balance of fun and learning. I want my students to have fun. I want to have fun. I want to see learning within my students, and I'm always learning. So I always have that sort of scales approach, that when you approach a lesson, are those scales, are you having fun within your learning? Is there learning happening? Is there too much fun at the expense of some deep learning? It's getting that balance. But it is about having fun and enjoying what you do. That's my takeaway, having been in and out of teaching when I wasn't enjoying it.
Yeah, I bet. No, I reckon the fact that you scale all your lessons that way means you're not really working. You are just having fun and getting outcomes at the same time.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think when you are doing what you enjoy, and particularly within science, environmental space, STEM, I do enjoy what I do, and working with kids who are not always, you know, we're not always looking for easy kids or the best kids. We want everybody to be exposed to this stuff. And often the kids who you might say, someone else will say, oh, they're trouble, or we have difficulty managing them. If you give them the right learning activity or exposure, then suddenly all that trouble disappears because you've hooked them in and you've brought them in. Now, it's not going to be the case for everybody, but I think in a lot of students, you really can bring them that little bit closer and have them buy into school, which is what we want, so that they're set up for secondary and wherever that may take them. Well, secondary is one, because you do lose kids in secondary, and I think the nature of secondary is far less flexible and open than the primary environment. And I'm glad I don't teach secondary.
I definitely used to be a high school science teacher, but I'm just thinking now, even just our role amongst, you know, doing outreach with our company, some of it brings us into behaviour schools and juvenile justice centres and places where things have clearly gone wrong for the kids for years upon years. And sometimes, often the teachers have brought us in going, you know what, if they get the science, that's great, and we'll be, you know, very, very happy. But to be honest, we just want the kids to stay in the room just for more than 5 minutes without fighting.
Yes.
And that's, you know, when you've hit that level, I mean, you do need something incredibly engaging. I must say, science is such a vehicle for that, and it works well.
It is. It's because it is that hands-on, it's visual learning, and it can be complex or it can be presented simply. You know, some of the simple things, you know, milk and food colouring and a bit of detergent, and everyone goes, wow. It's such a simple way in and a safe way in.
It totally is. It works with adults too. I mean, I've got to speak at a Rotary function, and that they're going to love that. I'm doing that tomorrow night, actually, with a number of Rotary people. It's a gimme of an experiment, but, gee, it's got some rich meaning when you actually pull it apart and go into it.
Exactly, and there's so much out there in terms of all the everyday things we use and around us, and particularly with design and, pardon me, design and make challenges, which obviously the engineering design process, which we went into a lot of years ago.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, my goals now are to sort of balance the design and make the engineering design. We want our students to be computational thinkers. That's a biggie for us that will be reflected in our school plan in the near future. But that's not necessarily coding and app creation. That's certainly an accessible way into it and a very obvious one. But I certainly wouldn't want the idea that everyone has to make an app to be the sole driver of coding and computational thinking, because there's much more to be done than that. Having that logical thinking process and being able to apply that to a range of learning areas and a range of opportunities is what it's about. And coding is one way of getting there, without doubt, and it is a good way with the likes of Lego and Spheros and Ozobots and what have you. I don't think it really matters which toy you use. It's what you get at the end. So that computational thinking is a biggie for us. Continuing to drive students to be critical and creative thinkers, to be resilient. Our students are used to the word failure. We want them to fail forward, in the sense that when you make a mistake, you look to how that can help you down the track.
Yep.
Failing forward is the biggie, and that delivers resilience. Another somewhat overused term, I guess, but an important one. So it's just many, many opportunities arise when you get this stuff working well, and when you have your staff on board, you have your principal on board and the community backing you, it obviously makes things a little bit easier as well.
I kind of wonder, I mean, especially when I speak with a lot, you know, highly experienced teachers, and I kind of wonder what would happen if they had this never-ending pot of money, what a school would look like. I mean, just trying to project in the future, imagine what it would be like if you are given this, right, we're just going to let you full reins of an account and we're not going to tell you how much is in there, just keep spending. But it doesn't have to be that spending. I kind of wonder what would schools look like if teachers had complete control and a never-ending supply of cash? What would it end up looking like? Or would it not actually be as full-on as people might envisage?
I don't think the spending would be the be-all and end-all. There'd still be a fair bit of money left in any account that I was using, even if I didn't know what was in it. I think the things I mean, older style school was built in the 60s. So infrastructure wise, I would look to something that's more contemporary with flexible spacing, flexible learning spaces, comfortable seating. Our students work in the hallways. They work on sofas. They work on beanbags. They can work pretty much anywhere as long as they are taking responsibility and ownership for their learning. We don't have enough desks in each classroom for all the students. For the sheer purpose, we don't want anybody falling into the trap of thinking they can teach to all the kids at a desk. So in any of our classrooms, you will find seating for, well, anything from a quarter to about half the students at one given time. The other students could be sitting on the floor. They could be at a stand-up table. They could be on their project work while the teacher's working on literacy and numeracy. So it's a very, you know, it is very differentiated, which is what learning has to be. But within that, we'll be receiving some award money from this prize, and that will, the initial discussions, we will be putting a little bit into resources along the lines of probably some Lego robotics, because I think that is still the best probably quality product that offers scope. But the vast majority of that will go into developing teacher capacity and sustainability through enabling me to do a little bit more mentoring and coaching and team teaching with individual teachers in terms of using outdoor spaces and indoor, so that all the teachers have the foundation. And a lot do. I mean, we're pretty good here, but we can always do a little better. We're very strong on teacher professional learning, and I think it's driving teacher professional learning in whatever way is needed is what gets you there, because it is the teacher in front of the students that makes the difference. It's not all the gee whiz bang furniture, toys and other things. They do, you know, they're tools to help. We're one-to-one, but we don't buy the devices. Will you students bring in their own BYOD, and we'll support those students that cannot do that. We have to, as part of equity, and we would never fail in that mission. I think money is about professional learning, and then about developing teachers as leaders so that all teachers can share and lead back within the school. We've done a lot of that work, and it's been quite positive in terms of when we run workshops and professional learning, any teacher might be up there as the leader. It's not always the principal or the assistant principal running the show, and I don't think it needs to be that anymore. It's not a power structure that says I'm stronger than you, or I'll divert to the AP, the assistant principal, and the assistant principal will divert to the principal, and so on. It's about everyone taking ownership and having an interest, and then building their expertise, and then sharing that back, and that makes the whole school a stronger and better place. And feed that back into the students as well.
That's fantastic, and I must say, in different words, but effectively the same way, every single person has been teaching for long enough says invest back in the teachers. They rarely ever say the building or the whatever. I mean, mind you, some people mention to a degree, but it's very much a clear thing that you see often, that if you just look after the people who are doing the teaching, everything else will flow as a result. And it doesn't matter if you only got access to water, sticks and string. It doesn't matter.
You know, everything comes down to culture, the culture of the work environment. We have a strong culture of trust, strong culture of, I guess, risk-taking. We've got a reasonably progressive outlook on educational pedagogy. We have a good team of people that fit that mold. You know, we have people who are the right fit for the school, and that is so important. So investing in the right people initially through recruitment is important, but then investing in their professional learning and investing in a commitment to allowing them to share back is vital as well. And that's that culture of trust, of responsibility, and then people feel they're in a place where they're welcomed and wanted. The students feel that, and then the community feels that. And when you've got the community behind you, it's very hard to go wrong.
Fantastic. Look, Neil Bramson, thanks so much for jumping on this podcast. Hey, I guarantee there's going to be someone out there who would love to get in touch with you. So how might they? How might they get in touch?
Okay, well, the easy way is the Twitter handle, which is at Galaxy Invader, GalaxyInvader, as it is, Galaxy Invader, a great old game from the 1980s.
Yeah, I thought that was what you're doing. have you got the symbol there instead of your face? Have you got a logo?
Galaxy Invader there. I had that before I was even interested in space and so on. And I thought,
I love Galaga.
Yeah, Galaga.
Galaga. That's my favourite. Fish and chip shop. I mean, yeah, I'm a kid of the 80s. I love that thing.
That's right. So that's an easy way. But obviously my email, and that would be my work email, which is neil.bramson, B-R-A-M-S-E-N at D-E-T. nsw.edu.au, and I think there's probably also my blog, which let me just check that because I sometimes get that wrong.
That's all right.
Neil Bramson, all one word, .edgyblogs.org. So I tend to keep that. It's not a weekly update. I'm not that type of blogger, but I tend to post on that once a month or so as interesting things are happening within project-based, purpose-based science, teaching and learning.
All right, and we'll be sure to put all those links in the show notes so everyone can go check that out, because you've got a wealth of stuff. And I'll also put a link through to your Churchill Fellowship report as well. And, you know, people can, you know, dive right into what you've been doing with. Yeah, I know it's the label, the outdoor education classroom or whatever they're calling it, but the reality is how to get kids involved in their learning, period. That's what it actually is.
On that note, I think we should also put a plug in for the likes of Churchill Fellowships, Fulbrights and other things that different countries offer that, you know, if you are keen to really extend your professional knowledge, it is great to visit others. I mean, you get to a point in your career where all your learning comes through networking and through sharing back with fellow peers at a level of expertise and interest. And some of my best, you know, the last few years, my best learning has really come through networking from people I've met overseas or in Australia. So don't be shy of going for those opportunities and backing yourself. And then, you know, continuing to build your own professional portfolio as you learn more and you can give more back.
Absolutely. And I will actually put some links into that. One that comes to mind is churchilltrust.com.au. That would be one to definitely check on that. And I suppose you just use your favorite Google version and just type in Fulbright or Rhodes or whatever. You'll find something out there. But yeah, there are a lot of opportunities. And they don't have to be the explicitly elite programs either. There's some great exchange programs that happen within cities.
Yeah, it's just about reaching out. The more you reach out as a professional, as an educator, and as a person, the more you get back.
Get involved with your associations. The teaching associations where it's at.
That's right. Mm-hmm. All righty.
Well, thank you very much, Neil, for popping in. I know you've got stuff to do. And look, you've got birds to count too.
I do, although I might let them rest for a little while as I'll let my legs rest as well.
All right, much appreciated.
Set of birds. All right, thanks, Ben.
Take it easy, mate.
This is the Physics Ed Podcast. We're all about science, ed tech and more. To see 100 fun free experiments you can do with your class, go to physicseducation.com.au. That's physics spelled F-I-Z-Z-I-C-S. And click 100 free experiments.
How good was that? Gotta love how enthusiastic Neil is with his students. I mean, that outdoor education thing is just brilliantly done, brilliantly instigated, and more importantly, it's not just about him and his students, he's spreading the message far and wide. And hey, Neil, well done. That was just a great interview, and I hope everyone listening got a lot out of it, and trust me, I certainly did. Hey, I'm going to go through my top three learnings, but I must say, I don't even know how to bring it down to three learnings, because there was a lot more than that. But hey, we've got to go somewhere. So first up, learning number one for me was scale. Use the scale. Use fun versus learning. Are your lessons only about fun and starting to, well, not really get into the true learning? Or are your lessons too much about the learning and the kids are looking a little bit bored? Constantly using that scale as a metric in your own head, going, are the kids engaged because they're having a bit of fun? That's a good thing. But are they having too much fun and maybe missing the deeper meaning? That was a really good idea and well worth, you know, putting into your classroom. Hey, number two, and this should really stand out massively, use the outdoors. Doesn't matter whether you're using kindergarten kids, year 12 kids, adult learners, using the outdoors. Even if you've only got a little bit outside, even if you're in a concrete jungle in the middle of a city somewhere, look up. There's going to be birds. There's going to be stars. There is the environment itself that you can use in some way. Kids love it. And actually, tell you what, getting outdoors is actually a bit of a circuit breaker for your class. It gives them a bit of a time to refresh, get their brain charged so they can head back into class and do some other things. And now, mind you, I'm going to do this like learning 2.A or B, one of the two. The fact that Niels is restricting having the number of desks in their classrooms is a great idea. The ability for kids to cycle around and have different positions and poses within their classroom is a great thing. Hey, learning number three, I guess, or learning four, or whatever we're going to say, is invest in your colleagues. I was very interested to hear what Neil had to say if he had this imaginary bucket of money that just kept on giving. And rather than worrying about the buildings and resources and tech and all these other little bells and whistles, he said straight and center, invest in the teachers, invest in the profession. And I must say, that is just brilliant.
Thanks for listening to the Physics Ed Podcast. Love your science? We do too. Here's this episode's education tip of the week. Grab your pencil and get ready to make some notes.
Yes, considering how passionate Neil Branson is about the environment, I think it would be remiss of me not to actually talk about what you could do when taking students outdoors and potentially even on a bush walk. So here are some ideas that can get those kids really thinking about their environment and some little lesson activities that will help boost it along too. So here we go. So first up, before you head off on a bush walk, let people know where you're going, and hopefully you've got some adults, some extra teachers who are first aid trained, so that if anything does go wrong, you can then look after the kids. So first up, before you go out in the outdoors, make sure people know where you're going and that the first aid's all dealt with. So knowing that, what are you going to do with the kids when you take them outdoors? I'd say first up is rather than looking for the big things, how about consider looking for the little things? You'd be amazed at the amount of biodiversity that can be found in leaf litter. Just get kids to wear gloves and get some tweezers and some sorting trays, and the kids can start looking through all the leaf litter, all the soil for the quite amazing amount of life that can be found underneath shrubs and bushes and trees and things. So try different vegetation types. Do you find more things under a particular shrub than another? Have kids look through it. And look, if you want to be a bit more rigorous, a bit more scientific, maybe bring along some things that can act as a quadrat. That could be just, a series of rulers taped together. Or if you want to get a bit fancy, I've even seen people cut up some bit of Rio bar, some Rio mesh, which you often see put into concrete. Yes, you can get some people to carry that along and act as a formal, bit of a quadrat as well. But there you go. Jumping into the leaf litter and have a bit of a look. Speaking of little things, bring yourself along some ice cube trays, some spoons and some dip nets and little things like that, and get the kids to see if they can do a bit of sorting through some aquatic organisms that they might find in the creek or lake or dam as they go along. If you've got an identification book along with you, it'll help you out trying to work out what is that little larval specimen that you found, or that tiny little thrip or something that you found. Just make sure that the kids have the right safety wear and all the rest be digging out amongst the reeds, but get them to actually have a bit of a look, and you'd be amazed what kids can find when they look in the aquatic area, not just in the terrestrial environment. Hey, as you're going along, see if you can bring along a couple of bits of equipment to take readings of relative humidity, temperature and wind speed and all that type of thing, especially if you're ascending a mountain or hill or something like that. You'd be amazed how many data points you'd be able to get out of a bushwalk. And hey, if you happen to own a data logger, this is really handy too. And tell you what, it brings a whole nother IT aspect into your bushwalk. Hey, if you get a chance, especially if you've got a school camp, maybe you could take kids out on a spotlighting mission. Go and find some arboreal mammals. Go find some things that are hanging out in the trees and see what you can find. Just be sure to keep to a well-formed track so no one trips over, and bring enough decent light so that you can find your way back and all that type of thing. But also just so you can find in amongst the bush all of the all the hidden creatures. The only issue with this particular idea is kids tend to be just a little bit excitable. We all know that as educators, but really when they go spotlighting, they really are. But the problem with that is that unless they're quiet, they're likely to lose the animals, because the animals are just going to get out of there before they even turn up. They're going to hide. So you'll have to give them a bit of a heads up about being quiet as they walk out. Hey, when you go out there, and Neil mentioned this in his discussion about using iPods, listen for things. There could be frog croaks, there could be bird calls. Bring a smart device along so you can record those sounds, and then jump onto some apps to work out what that thing is. Especially if you've got a naturalist with you, and ask your local National Parks and Wildlife Service or a similar thing, you might be able to have someone along who can tell you exactly what you're doing. Bring along some binoculars, bring along a copy of a local bird identification book. It's really, really handy. For those who really want to bring in a bit of maths, you could have kids measuring the heights of trees using a clinometer. That's kind of handy, and if you're not sure what a clinometer is, just type in clinometer into Google and you'll be able to find it's actually not too hard. So look, there's a bit of a tip there. Get your kids out to the environment and make sure, just as Neil was talking about, make sure that not only is it a fun little engaging activity, make sure there's some rich learning and some deeper meaning in the lesson itself.
This is the Physics Ed Podcast. We're excited about science. Grab a copy of our new book, Be Amazing: How to Teach Science the Way Primary Kids Love, from our website. Just search Be Amazing Book. It's available in hard copy and ebook. Go to physicseducation.com.au. That's physics spelled FIZZICS.
no matter how good your lesson is, no matter how good your materials are, it really just comes down to, just like Neil was talking about, how enthusiastic and primed you are about learning about the world. And tell you what, the kids will really feed off your own enthusiasm. And tell you what, Sybilla Seidler from our last podcast with the Little Scientist had something to say about that as well.
Like, am I actually looking at the world with open eyes? And am I, you know, how many questions do I have about the world on a regular basis? So this is really, from our perspective, the foundation. To say, you know, the more curious I am as an educator, the more inquiry-based science, the more exciting discoveries I can make with my children.
Without a doubt, what Sybilla talks about in that interview is very much a common thread throughout all of our guests on the Physics Ed podcast. So definitely go check out last week's episode and all of the back catalogue, because there's very much some interesting thoughts when it comes to teaching science. And especially go check out episode 4. That's where Jackie Randalls from Inspiring Australia talks about different ways you can get your kids involved in citizen science. Well worth your time.
Thanks for listening to the Physics Ed podcast. Sign up now for our fortnightly email newsletter. It's loaded with details on new experiments you can do, STEM teaching articles, new gadgets, exclusive offers, and upcoming events. Go to physicseducation.com.au. Scroll to the bottom and add your email.
And that brings us yet to the end of another Physics Ed podcast. Hey, next week's also a big week. We're speaking with Ali Watson from Code Like a Girl, finding out exactly what she's been doing all over Australia to get kids as young as 10 years old into coding. And it's well worth your time. And I certainly enjoyed having that interview. Until then, please make your classrooms as invigorating and as enthusiastic and as awesome as possible when it comes to teaching STEM. You've been listening to me, Ben Newsom from Physics Education, and you've been listening to the Physics Ed podcast. Bye for now.
You've been listening to another Physics Ed podcast. We're excited about science. Subscribe to us on iTunes to download the next episode as soon as it's released. And don't forget, for hundreds of ideas, free experiments, our new Be Amazing book, and more, go to physicseducation.com.au.